rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on the web on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. Welcome to our program. Terrible events in the United Kingdom this morning. At 10 minutes after 9, the same time the World Trade Center was struck on 9/11. In the train stations, the tubes, the subway, they call it the tube in the UK, in the train stations, three major bombs went off, one in a bus, a double-decker bus. We have with us live Paul Hannum. Paul is a political scientist, a lecturer at Oxford University, live from the London area. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom.
Glad to have you with us, although the circumstances are not the kind that we would celebrate.
No.
Describe the train stations. This the area where this happened. This was, Aldgate East and Liverpool Street tube stations, Russell Square and King's Cross tube stations, and the Edgware tube, Road tube station.
Yeah.
What are these places like?
Well, they're all in central London, but they're split down the middle. Aldgate East, Liverpool Street, Moorgate are in what's called the City of London, which is one of the three great financial centres of the world. It would be the equivalent of Wall Street, but probably covering a much bigger area. Hundreds of thousands of people commute here to work here every day, and that was clearly the deliberate strategy there. Now, the other ones still near there, within probably 2 miles to the west of that, and they're near what's called the West End, which is a theatre district. Mm-hmm. And Edgware Road is right next to Hyde Park, where the big Live Aid concert was this weekend. So, you know, it's really at the heart of London.
So this would be sort of like in New York City, bombs going off in Wall Street and in the northern part of Midtown, right up against Central Park.
Yeah, and Times Square. I mean, absolutely. Yeah, it's right in the heart of London, where there are 3 million people coming into work in central London, commuting. And at that time, 10 to 9, that's when it would be most busy. Most people, you know, still come to work 9 to 5, 9 to 6. So it was designed a maximum.
Here in the U.S., we're getting reports that there are 33 confirmed dead and 300 to 600 casualties. Is that what you're hearing there in the U.K. as well?
Yeah, I'm hearing different things, but certainly 33 confirmed. I've heard up to 1,000 injured. The big unknown is how many people were killed on that bus. Clearly, they still are identifying the bodies or clarifying the number there. This was absolutely appalling. I don't know if your listeners have seen what happened to the bus. It was completely packed. They were turning away passengers, I understand, and the top half was completely destroyed, and the bottom is what we call a double-decker bus, of two levels, and down below was completely destroyed as well from what we could see. So this could be a huge number of dead there.
How many will a bus hold, Paul?
Oh, it's difficult. You see people even stand up, sit down. I wouldn't like to say exactly, but over 100, I would say, potentially, or certainly that sort of figure, yeah.
Yeah, so there's 33 dead is almost certain to go up.
Unfortunately, I would imagine. And we don't know how many of the seriously ill are critically injured and face death, too. But I would imagine it will go up a lot more.
Paul, how are the British people reacting to this at the moment? Is there any political reaction yet, or is it entirely just the news, just the shock of the blood?
I think is greatest, and the shock, not just because it was a terrorist attack. I think everybody expected there would be a terrorist attack, but the fact that it's come the day after London won the Olympic bid, the fact that it's come at the time of G8, when all these other issues are at the forefront, and suddenly, you know, we've been talking about nothing but poverty and climate change in the papers for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And with the Live Aid concerts, which several billion people watch worldwide, that brought that to the front. And so I think it's a mood of complete shock. There's been very little analysis so far, although I have been reading that there is a real fear of backlash against the Muslim community, which is very worrying. And we've been appealing for calm. Unfortunately, very right-wing political parties have been getting stronger over the last few years, and unfortunately they will use this.
They will exploit this, which,
oh, absolutely.
Which raises the question, what impact will this have on Tony Blair's political career and on his legacy?
Well, I think it depends how people link it. If they link it to him going to war, it will damage him more. Take away the war in Iraq from Tony Blair's prime ministership, and you have a very successful man, you know, who could have gone down as one of the greats. The war has damaged him. The question is, how will this affect support for war? Will it make people more determined, or will it make people think even more that we should never have gone to war and look what's happened? It's too early to say at this moment.
And Tony Blair saying that our values and our way of life will not be destroyed by these blasts. Do you think that the majority of folks in the UK think that Al Qaeda blew up this bus and these trains because of your values and way of life?
I think a lot of people will think it's to do with the war. And I think a lot of people will also think it's a general attack on Western life. And London is one of the major Western cities in the world, with New York, you know, Paris. It could have been here. It could have been, well, Madrid, of course, we had several years ago. It's difficult to know how much this is a generalized attack against Western culture and Western powers, particularly coinciding with the G8, which just seems too coincidental not to be important. Some people have said it was something to do with the Olympics, which is absurd because, frankly, nobody expected us to win yesterday. Paris was a huge favorite. I think a lot of people are going to look at the war, but my feeling is that this will actually strengthen people's resolve not to pull out, but that might be seen as a weakness. I think a lot of newspapers will say this.
Yeah, in fact, the BBC is reporting that they have the full text of the statement that was posted on a website of what purports to be an al-Qaeda group. In fact, they say that this is the secret organization group of al-Qaeda, of jihad organization in Europe. And the statement comes right out and says, "Rejoice, for it is time to take revenge against the British Zionist Crusader government in retaliation for the massacres Britain is committing in Iraq and Afghanistan." And they say Britain is now burning with fear, terror, and panic, and that they had repeatedly warned the British government and people. And then they go on to say, "We continue to warn the governments of Denmark and Italy and all the Crusader governments that they will be punished in the same way if they do not withdraw their troops from Iraq and Afghanistan." What's remarkable to me, Paul, is this is one of the first of these Al-Qaeda jihadist rants I've seen that doesn't mention Israel. It's like we have become, the UK and the United States have become the boogeyman now, instead of you know, Israel, which was the perennial boogeyman for the fundamentalist Islamics.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Certainly, you know, I remember vividly the 70s and 80s, where Israel was the subject of most of the terrorist attacks.
Well, even up until a couple of years ago, they were always mentioning Israel, even when they were attacking us.
Well, that's right, and I think
9/11.
The deeper question is, what has been the effect of going to war in Iraq? I think a lot of political scientists regard this as the best recruiting drive possible for terrorist extremist groups, because they can see what they see as the enemy every night on their TV at war, and this is the question.
And this is going to be a very, very important one to watch, to see if Tony Blair plays this the way that the British responded to IRA attacks, which ultimately led to reconciliation and peace, or whether he's going to play it the way George Bush responded to 9/11, which led to our invading two different countries, one of which had nothing to do with 9/11, and then, you know, ultimately led to this. Is this going to begin the road to peace, or is this going to begin the road to what may even be a world war?
Well, that's a good question. My gut feeling, my intuition is it's not going to lead to peace. I think it's a very different situation to what was happening with the IRA. And I think when I watched Tony Blair earlier, I've never seen him look more disturbed, more worried, more anxious. And I think one of his biggest issues is the fact that he'd put his whole of his term into getting the G8 summit set up for dealing with poverty and climate change. And this has come along and taken the momentum out of all of that work. And this is the last thing. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy to happen, but also in world agenda terms, this is a terrible blow, because we really do need to deal with these two important issues of climate change and poverty. And we're all set up to do something, I think, spectacular this week, potentially. Yeah, I don't think that will happen now. So there was a real sense of frustration, disappointment, and I don't know what the organizers of Live 8 must be feeling now after all the work they've done.
Yeah, we're talking with Paul Hannam, a political scientist and lecturer at Oxford University, live from London, or the London area. Paul, you lived through the era of the IRA bombings. In fact, you had a couple go off relatively close to where you were staying or living.
Yes, I live in Guildford, where there was a bomb in 1974 that killed five people, the same week as the Birmingham bomb, which was made into the film, In the Name of the Father, where 19 people were killed. But there's been nothing on the scale of what happened today. To have this level of coordinated attack with so many deaths and injuries, this is way beyond what happened in the IRA. With the IRA.
On the other hand, this is nothing close to what happened in World War II. So,
well, no, that's absolutely right.
The people of your nation have been through a lot over the years. How have they typically responded?
Well, I always remember my late father talking about working throughout the Blitz. You know, he'd get in the morning, he'd often have to leave his railway carriage and walk 10 miles into London, and, you know, he'd be there with bombs going off, and people just got used to it. It's extraordinary what you and I would regard as terrifying. People habituated to very quickly. There was an amazing resolve and a determination. And these terrorist attacks, they rarely weaken that resolve, I think, particularly in places like Britain.
Yeah, okay. Paul Hannum, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. I so appreciate your perspective and you're taking the time to be here with us. And
well, my pleasure, Tom.
Let us here in the U.S. know what's going on in the U.K. there. Paul Hannum, thank you. This a terrible situation in the U.K. now, this bombing, these four bombings now, actually, four separate bombs that went off. And it appears, actually, that the very first one went off at 9:10 a.m. local time, the same time that the first plane hit the World Trade Center. And some folks suggesting that's no coincidence. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Gary, a trucker in Ohio, is on the line. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. My comment is somewhat tangential to what happened over in Britain. Going back a little bit to Valerie Plame exposing her, a lot of people thought that this was for revenge or a way of getting even with him. I see this war, this conflict that we're in, is a conflict against that. The only way of fighting it, or really knowing how to fight it, is with accurate information. And I think an area that I haven't heard talked about very much, I think you alluded to it one time that I can remember, but anyway, a greater motivation is a way of intimidating the source of accurate information, basically CIA and that sort of thing, which would allow the administration to do whatever they want and to manipulate the media and the news, because they are second obvious that the only source of other accurate information.
Yeah, spot on, Gary. We're going to be talking later in the day, in fact, with Ray McGovern, a 27-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency and co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, about that very topic, this big problem. Gary, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. The place where smart people get their news. News without global corporate interests of conflict. There you go.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, tomhartman.com, our website. And a disastrous explosion, a series of four explosions in London. As they first happened, the word came out that it was a transformer that had overloaded. Apparently that was the best guess. This when the first one happened underground. And George W. Bush was at the conference in Gleneagles, Scotland, at the G8 conference, and he slipped away. Stepped out of the room. He's got this super cool video teleconference doodad that he carries with him wherever he goes now. And immediately hooked himself up to Washington, D.C., got on the line with Michael Chertoff and the folks at the Department of Homeland Security, and they concluded, even before it had been announced to the press, perhaps before the British had concluded, although frankly I would assume that they were getting their intelligence from the British, concluded that this was the work of terrorists, that they were experiencing an act of terrorism, and that, you know, things needed to be done about it. I spoke this morning on my local program on KPOJ, in Portland, Oregon, with Governor Ted Kulongoski of the state of Oregon. And the governor told us that he had just spoken with the Department of Homeland Security, and they had said that the threat level was being raised to orange. What was interesting about that, and that has happened, although only for mass transit. That's the thing that I find particularly unique and interesting about this, is that before the election, every time bad news about George Bush came out, the threat level, boom, went up. And communities started complaining about it, saying, hey, it's costing us a fortune for all this overtime for all these police officers. You know, we can't really deal with this. And so now it's just mass transit. Now it's very thoughtful and specific. And of course, this is the first increase in the threat level that we've had since the election, which gives some credibility to Tom Ridge's concern that he was like, you know, Tom Ridge, the guy who was raising the threat level, who was put the threat levels out, said after he left his job as Department of Homeland Security director that the White House had told him when to do it, and he disagreed with them on a lot of occasions before the elections. But now we have a real one because, gee, there's a real terrorist event, at least in the U.K. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Rod in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Rod.
Hey, Tom. Love your program. I wanted to just say that, in my opinion, as always, this is retaliation in the religious war, and it's not Islam against Christianity or against Judaism or anything else. It's Islam against capitalism, because in their mind, capitalism is the religion and money is the god, so they strike at the heart of the economic powers. And one more thing, I wanted to get your opinion on how long it's going to take them to start blaming this on someone in Iran or Syria to advance their next agenda.
That's a good question. Probably about a day. I mean, you know, it's
probably so.
Yeah. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if Fox News was reporting it right now.
I wanted to quickly say, did you see the thing on Fox News on Saturday night about them already putting out the propaganda about what a dangerous nuclear threat Iran is?
No, but I get all those guys who are guests on Fox News. They all send emails to our program saying, you know, let us come on your program. We'll tell you all about this. And
oh my God,
oddly enough, when I try to book them, they then say, oh, the Tom Hartman. No, we don't want to go on that program.
Of course, because they have nothing to stand on.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I'm not going to suck up to them. I'm going to ask them hard questions, and they're
good
just
man.
Very, very unpleasant, unhappy about that. They don't like that
we
at all.
We love you, Tom. We love you so much.
Well, thanks a lot, Rod. I appreciate it. Very, very kind to hear from you, and thank you for calling. And you raise a really important issue, and this is this a war of Islam against Christianity, or Islam against capitalism, or Islam against Western society, or is it we kicked over the beehive and now the bees are coming at us? I think it's really important that we keep in mind that Osama bin Laden back in the 1990s told us why he was going to come and get us. He said it was because in the 91 Gulf War, we put soldiers on Saudi soil, and because we were propping up the Saudi royal family that was pumping out the wealth of his nation. And he considered that desecration. And so, you know, imperialist policy or whatever you want to call it, manipulative policies around the world coming home to haunt us. Terrible situation. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Welcome back to our program. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Ian Williams is with us. Ian Williams is the author of United Nations for Beginners and The Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families. In 1987, he was a speechwriter for the UK Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock during the elections. And tell me if I've got this right, Ian. You once got into a drinking competition with Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai?
Yes, it was New Year's Eve, so we were in a festive spirit. I won, by the way.
How did that happen? How did you win? I mean, how did you end up in a drinking competition with the Premier of China?
I'm trying to save this for my memoirs.
I was
a teenage Maoist. Instead of being a teenage werewolf, I was a teenage Maoist.
I see.
I was invited to Shiner to sort of promote the revolution.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, the other important bit was I actually argued English literature with Madame Mao at the same event and survived, which is really big and significant.
Yeah, a lot of
nobody
people,
else did.
People who argued anything with anybody named Mao didn't survive.
Not often, no.
Now, you came back from Maoism, I guess, to the UK Labour Party, and I'm wondering how was Neil Kinnock's Labour Party different from Tony Blair's and in their response to terrorism? How has the Labour Party changed over the years? We have this horrific bombing today in London, but London has been experiencing bombings for quite some time, the IRA, World War II. How has the Labour Party been historically responded to this sort of thing?
Well, we had some arguments at the time of when the IRA started, they passed the equivalent of the Patriot Act, which was the Prevention of Terrorism Act, and a lot of us opposed it because it was produced unnecessary infringements on civil liberties.
Is it still in place?
I think elements of it still are. Most of them have gone. It allowed for detention without trial, and people could be deported from one part of the United Kingdom to another. People from Northern Ireland could be refused entry onto the mainland, mm-hmm. which in a sense almost gave the IRA their case, because they were saying it was a separate country.
Oh, interesting.
But no, it was different because the IRA was trying to cause chaos. It wasn't trying to cause casualties. And, I mean, allowing for a large degree of incompetence, and a lot of people were killed, their civilian bombing campaigns, they usually tried to give notice, and sometimes they were late, and sometimes they sort of misplaced with the bombs and said that they were somewhere else. Mostly it would appear accidentally. And so people were killed almost inadvertently. I mean, a lot of people were killed, so it's not to exonerate them in any way. But remember that bombing campaign and the whole Northern Ireland thing took several thousand lives. So people in Britain got used to it. The litter baskets were covered over. You couldn't leave luggage in stations. Suitcases, anything unattended was immediately whisked away and treated as, I had friends whose briefcases were blown up because they'd left them, somewhere.
Yeah.
No, people didn't take any chances.
And that's still the case, by and large.
I think it's died down a lot as the IRA bombing campaign finished, but people still maintain a lot of sort of vigilance like that. And
mm-hmm.
So I think with this, it's very difficult to think of any way that you can sort of keep on living in a crowded city without taking risks like this.
Yeah, we're speaking with Ian Williams. Ian is the author of the United Nations UN for Beginners and The Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families. In 1987, a speechwriter for UK Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock during the elections. And
now, while we're getting the plugs in, do you mind my next book? I just got the hard copies yesterday.
Oh, please
coming
go
out
for it.
Next, yeah. Coming out later this month is Rum, A Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776.
Okay. Rum. All righty. Author also of Rum, appropriate for the guy who beat Cho and Lai in a drinking competition. Now, how is the United... Oh, and the reason why, just if anybody just tuned in and has, this is your first moment of consciousness coming out of this program, horrific bombings this morning in London, in three explosions in three different tube stations, actually two of them not even in the stations, between stations as trains were traveling, apparently, terrible explosions, and one in the second floor of a double-decker bus, and 33 confirmed casualties, as many as 1,000 people injured, and certainly the death toll numbers are sure to increase dramatically. Because
I think you just hit the crucial word that people should remember, the tube system.
Yeah.
This isn't big open tunnels like in the New York subway system. These are actual tubes burrowed through, so the blast is confined in a very small place, and it makes it very difficult for rescue workers and to get to the train.
Yeah, they don't have the gratings that go into the sidewalk like New York. I mean, the subway in London, first of all, it was built during the Victorian era, and secondly, it's very deep.
It's much, much deeper, and it's apart from some of the older systems, it's actually burrowed straight through the clay, and as I said, it's a tube.
Mm-hmm.
The only concession to air conditioning on London Transport until recently was the fact that when the train went through, it produced a draft.
Yeah, yeah.
But the primary ventilation system. But it really is horrendous. I remember at the time of there was a train accident on the underground about 20 years ago in Moorgate, and it was a horrifying just reading the descriptions because of the confined space.
Yeah, and this
and the difficulty of getting anything, you know, rescuers in or out.
This is no doubt is going to be far worse, and certainly not anything for a claustrophobic to be participating in. I'm curious. You wrote a book about the United Nations. How do you think, Ian Williams? How do you think that? Oh, by the way, your website. Since we're doing plugs here, ianwilliams.info. Info. ianwilliams.info. How do you think the United Nations is going to respond to this? Is this going to be the sort of thing? You know, there are those who were suggesting, and I was among them back when 9/11 first happened, that if Bush used that to become the warrior king, that he could literally, over a period of time, touch off World War III. And if, on the other hand, he were to have used that incident the way Bill Clinton did with the bombing in Oklahoma City, by declaring the perpetrators criminals, he could pull the entire world together. You could have Interpol launch a worldwide manhunt, bring these people to justice, and people could have closure like the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing did. And Bush, of course, chose the former. He chose to declare a war without end. Amen. Don Rumsfeld now saying at least 12 more years just in Iraq. And heaven only knows how long it's going to be anywhere else. How do you think the UN is going to handle all this?
To begin with, I have to say that immediately afterwards, my apprehension, I was relieved after a week that Havana and Moscow and
after 9/11.
Pyongyang went nuclear deserts, because I'm sure there's probably some people in the Pentagon who thought, let's get them now.
Yeah.
We should in some ways be thankful that they picked on lesser targets, but the war on terror was quite clear from the documentation now that was when they decided to use the hysteria, the justifiable hysteria to some extent over the World Trade Center, to go after Iraq. And the distinction in Britain is that people there know that the war in Iraq has nothing to do with the war on terror.
Do you think everybody knows that? I mean, you've got the Sun over there that's owned by Rupert Murdoch, and it's much like Fox News here. It's been waving the flag for going to war, and isn't it a great thing? And let's make more bombs, and let's give more money to military contractors.
But they haven't done it on the grounds of the war on terror. They've done it on the grounds that Saddam Hussein was a really evil person, and now it's started. We must support our boys. I mean, they're dealing with a pretty skeptical public in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And
a strong opposition press, by the way. You've got The Observer, you've got The Independent, you've got The Guardian in particular. You've got some papers that I guess The Independent and The Guardian are the big ones, speak out. I mean, they just speak out against Blair's policies or against the war.
Well, we have nothing like that in the United States. Well, the distinguishing factor is even the sort of loyalist press in the U.S., in the U.K., is likely to rip into a government. I've always been surprised, since I've been here 15 years, and I'm still regularly surprised at how deferential the American media are towards their leaders.
Hmm. Well, I have to tell you, it's something that, because you've only been in the United States 15 years, it's something that I was doing news back in the 1970s, the early 1970s, and the American press, in many regards, was not at all deferential to our leaders. In fact, without the American press, Watergate never would have happened, or the Watergate scandal. I mean, the Watergate break-in certainly would have. But this has tracked very closely. This change in the American media has tracked the consolidation of media into a very small number of hands, very large multinational corporate hands, corporations that have interests outside of simply the news. That is, they're doing a whole lot of different things. General Electric, for example, one of the largest defense contractors in the United States, also makes nuclear power plants. They own NBC. And so you end up with Brian Williams, who's like now the number one newscaster for 52 weeks in a row or whatever. They just report a big deal, who says publicly that he thinks it's part of his job responsibility to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. So, I mean, this is, you know, there's the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned about is here and owns an awful lot of our media. So let me just, inform you, as it were, that this isn't how it used to be in America.
I'm well aware that things are getting worse all the time.
I interrupted you in mid-story. You were talking about the British press. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but also one of the points about the British press is it's a national press. You've got a dozen national newspapers, each of whom are monitoring what the others are saying. And if any of them really come out with a big lie or distortion, then the rest will jump on it like a wolf on a lamb. And and regardless of politics.
But see, CNN doesn't do that to Fox.
No, well, CNN decided that the answer to Fox is to emulate Fox.
Yeah.
I appear regularly on Fox. I describe myself as the lion being thrown to the Christians.
Okay. Just got it.
It's an interesting experience because Fox, you've got to admire Fox technically, and the Murdoch press generally. They produce brilliant headlines. They write brilliant copy. And Fox is actually much more sophisticated than, say, MSNBC or Rush Limbaugh because they always like a good fight. They always like to fix the fight, but they do like it. You know, they realize that good television is from, you know, a spirited conflict in which they've loaded the dice so that they win, of course. But they would, you need that type of cut and thrust to get going.
Right. People slow down for car accidents and fights. So how do you think the United Nations is going to respond to this? Back to this original question.
Well, I'm not quite sure what extra it can do. I mean, they've got pretty much unprecedented global controls on the movement of money, on the movement of people, on information exchange. And the real problem is the governments are exploiting the systems that are already in there. Uzbekistan, our glorious ally in the fight against terror, killed 500 civilians with weapons and troops that have been trained by the U.S. for fighting terrorism.
And to this day, we have not officially responded to that beyond...
Oh, yes, we have. We've renewed the base lease, I think, for the air base.
Yeah, okay.
And, we know that there is a Cuban terrorist accused of blowing up an airliner. I think he's admitted it, blowing up a Cuban airliner from Venezuela. The Venezuelans want to extradite him, and the U.S. is playing shy about it.
He's living in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's this constant, this worry about what is actually a terrorist. The Chinese, for example, and all the resolutions at the U.N., wanted separatist activities to be added to terrorism, which means that, you know, the Texas Minutemen would be terrorists, which some of them might well be. But Scottish nationalists and people like that. This is what Tim McVeigh was all about. Yes.
I mean, Tim McVeigh had read the Turner Diaries, which is this book in which somebody blows up, the hero of the book blows up a federal building, and it causes the federal government to respond with a law that... Patriot Act, basically, a law that suspends civil liberties and gives the government the right to hold people indefinitely without, you know, incommunicado. And the good white Christian, well-armed people in America rise up against the government and coincidentally against Jews and people of color. And that leads to an Armageddon-style war in the United States where the only people left standing are those well-armed white Christians, Protestant Christians, I should add. And when Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma, he fully expected that Bill Clinton's response was going to be an over-response like George Bush did with 9/11 in Iraq. And that would then lead to a popular revolt in the United States. Well, he was wrong, but it looks like Osama bin Laden had the same thing in mind, and he was right.
Well, it's a basic terrorist technique. In general, the people who are terrorists are people who don't have popular support. That's why they resort to terrorism. And the successful terrorist groups are the ones that provoke that type of counter-reaction, which... in the end, excites public opinion. You could say, for example, it'd be an unpopular one, but it's an appropriate one. The people who threw the tea overboard in the Boston Harbor were unpopular. They didn't really represent the public, but the British response was to clamp down the whole port of Boston and actually made Sam Adams and his bunch of smugglers who were throwing the tea overboard immensely popular figures because the British overreaction provoked support on their behalf. And it's been the same in right across the world with terrorist activities. And I think the Europeans have responded in a much more measured way to the recent terrorist outbreak.
Historically, yeah. The Italians with the Red Brigades, the Greeks with November 17, the British with
the Spanish. The Spanish response, for example, ETA. One of the problems is a lot of leftists here and abroad have sneaking sympathies for these people. You need to have no sympathy for a group that could stand for election, loses elections, gets a tiny minority of the votes, and then goes blowing people up to substantiate its cause.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in Spain, since Franco went, there's been no excuse for the ETA to be bombing because an overwhelming majority of their own Basque people that they're fighting for reject them. And yeah. similarly with the IRA in Northern Ireland and in Ireland. And the majority of Irish people have repudiated what the IRA has been doing.
And thus the resort to terrorism. It's a fascinating discussion. Ian Williams, ianwilliams.info, your website. Ian Williams, a speechwriter for the UK Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock during the 1987 elections, and the author of several books, including UN for Beginners, The Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, and Rum. What's the subtitle of that, Ian?
A social and sociable history of the real spirit of 1776.
There you go. Ian Williams, thanks so much for being with us. Much appreciated.
Tom.
Have a great one. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
Welcome back, my friends.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
Step by step, effort by effort, vote by vote, election by election, democracy is coming to the USA. Unless it gets derailed. Well, no, I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't. I really think Americans are waking up. And part of the waking up process will be, no doubt, recognizing the horror of what just happened in the UK and some of the reasons behind it. We can't just have a jingoistic response to mass killing. It doesn't work. It's just having an absolute jingoistic response where, oh, you know, they're the evil ones, we're the good ones, end of sentence. I'm sorry. It's not going to work. What it's going to do is it's going to get us deeper and deeper into these situations. We need to be looking at the causes of this thing. And that is not to say that you don't respond to it forcibly. But you also look at the causes of situations like this and you say, you know, what role have we played in this? How can we avoid this kind of thing in the future? And when you've got the group that claims credit for having done it, saying that the reason why they did this is because we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have to scratch your head and say, gee, should we have gone into Iraq and Afghanistan? When you've got Osama bin Laden back, you know, 10 years ago saying he's going to come attack us if we don't pull our troops out of Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, George Bush did last year, finally, pulled our troops out of Saudi Arabia. But you have Osama bin Laden saying he's going to attack us if we don't do that. You have to think, hey, maybe there's something to this. Maybe there are folks who really don't want American troops in their country. Maybe they just, you know, they don't want to be occupied. And when we do occupy them, there's blowback. I mean, look at the French and the Algerians. Look at the British and the Indians. Look at the British and the Americans. When you occupy another country, when you occupy a foreign country, and particularly if you're taking their resources. Look at all the oil we've pumped out of Iraq without even running a meter, without even paying the country for it. Look at all of the oil that we've taken. When you do that, you have to expect that there's going to be a consequence to it. And this, unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, the consequence of the failed, misguided policies, in my opinion, of the Bush and Blair administrations. And our hearts and prayers go out to the people who have lost their lives and their loved ones. And those who are frightened for same in the United Kingdom, let's hope that it is a lesson for all of us, that we can learn and move forward in a positive way toward world peace rather than world war. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Cover. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on this this day of terrible tragedy in London. 1,000 injured, as many as 1,000 injured in the UK bombings. The earlier numbers now, 33 confirmed dead. That number certainly going to rise, probably at least double the best estimates that I'm seeing. So we have a true tragedy on our hands here. George Galloway, who has been a guest on this radio program, the fellow who, in America, most Americans took note of George Galloway, British Member of Parliament, when he took on Norm Coleman before the United States Senate. George Galloway, first of all, starts out today. He issued a statement on this. He says, no one can condone the acts of violence aimed at working people going about their daily lives. They've not been a party to, nor are they responsible for the decisions of their government. They are entirely innocent, and we condemn those who have killed or injured them. And I absolutely agree. And he goes on to say, the loss of innocent lives, whether in this country or Iraq, is precisely the result of a world that has become less safe and less peaceful in recent years. We have worked without rest to remove the causes of such violence from our world. We argued, as did the security services of this country, that the attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq would increase the threat of a terrorist attack in Britain. Tragically, Londoners have now paid the price of the government ignoring such warnings. We urge the government to remove people in this country from harm's way, as the Spanish government acted to remove its people from harm's way by ending the occupation of Iraq and by turning its full attention to the development of a real solution to the wider conflicts in the Middle East. Only then will the innocents here and abroad be able to enjoy a life free of the threat of needless violence. This is from George Galloway in the U.K. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. We're going to have Ray McGovern with us in just a moment. Jim in Chicago on the line. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Jim?
Well, just along your whole thoughts, what we've set up is really a system that's going to lead to a genocide of the Arab and the Muslim population. The more we kill, the more they're going to hate us. And we really need to, I think, move towards, the healing.
Yeah, I would argue the Crusades didn't work out all that well. Why do it again?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
If we're willing to admit that we've made mistakes, if we desecrate the Iran in, or the Quran in Abu Ghraib and other detention centers, why don't we acknowledge that we've desecrated it by occupying their sacred ground, pull out, apologize.
Yeah.
And if we can do no more harm, we can be blamed for not more.
The problem, Jim, is that you've got about half of the people who voted for George Bush in the last election, which is, I think if you do the math, it works out to be something like somewhere between 9 and 20% of the American population who believe that Saddam Hussein in Iraq actually had something to do with 9/11. And, until you get through to these people and say, no, I'm sorry, Fox News has been lying to you, but with all these implications, it ain't going to happen.
Well, you have to keep backing it up. You say, well, what happened before that?
There you go.
And what happened before that?
Yep.
And people can't argue. And then when we're not to blame anywhere, and if people's societies in the Middle East are failing and turning in on themselves, they can only blame their own religious leadership, and maybe then will their culture of thought start to change.
There you go. Well said, Jim. And this is exactly what's happening in Iran, some would say, at least what was happening up until about a year ago when we started getting really pushy in Iran was actually happening there, that you were seeing change happen. Ray McGovern is with us. Ray is the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Officers for Sanity. And he's also the author of a book coming out next month, Neocon Again, a 27-year veteran of the CIA. Ray, you actually, at one point in your career with the CIA, were preparing the president's daily briefings, the PDBs. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I would take the town in the morning and brief people one-on-one, the vice president, secretaries of state and defense, and two other high officials.
And so when in August 6th of 2001, this was August, September, October, 2 months before 9/11, or a month before 9/11, when George Bush received a presidential daily briefing that said, as a headline, Osama bin Laden determined to strike within the U.S., And here now we have what, you know, what's going on in England, sort of an echo of that. When George Bush received that, and you, I'm sure, on television saw Condoleezza Rice testify that that was merely a historical document, what did you think?
Well, when I saw her testify, or when she made her initial remarks, I wasn't surprised. Her record for truth is not all that impressive. The title suggests what the article was all about. The 9/11 Commission skimmed over that rather quickly once they got Condoleezza Rice to read the title. That seemed to have been the deal. What this really betrays here is two things. Not only did we have ample evidence that something like 9/11 was being prepared, and the president and Condoleezza Rice just didn't know what to do about it, but also we had sort of a who shot John approach to it. You know, this is going to happen, and there's no real effort, as we used to do in past days, to get below the events and say, well, why would they want to target us? Why would they want to knock down buildings? Why would they want to do terrorism here?
Why would they want to blow up the tube in London? Why, Ray?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, you see. Now, if you go back to the 9/11 Commission report, you'll see that they pretended, or they were charged to prepare a full and complete account of the circumstances surrounding the 9/11 terrorist attacks, including the why of the attacks. And instead of the dumbed-down bromide that we've been fed, you know, they hate our democracy, they hate our freedom, you have to look to well inside the report to page 147 when they realized, we have the mastermind of this whole thing, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. We have him. Why don't we ask him why he did it?
Yeah.
And so they did. And this is what he said. He said, I have a violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. And a footnote in that section points to what his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, said when he was sentenced in New York to a prison term of 240 years. He said that the U.S. is supporting terrorism against Palestinians, and added that he was proud to fight any country that supports this kind of terrorism. So that's at the core of these issues. And
well, that was originally at the core of the issues.
Yeah, and it still is. And what's missing from the debate in this country is an acknowledgement that when Bush came in, and as we know from Paul O'Neill, who was there at his very first National Security Council meeting on the 30th of January 2001, when he changed U.S. policy toward the Arab, the Israeli-Palestinian problem, and said, we're going to tilt in one direction, we know who our friends are, no more of this honest broker stuff, that was clear to the world, and that deprived the Arab side, that deprived the Palestinians of the hope that they need for a more secure future, for a better future. And when you have no hope, you resort to these kinds of things. This is not to excuse it or to condone it in any way, but we have to try to understand it, and we can't dismiss it by saying they hate our democracy.
Isn't there a story about Yasser Arafat having snubbed George Bush at one point, and thus, when Bush became president, he refused to talk to Arafat?
I don't really put much stock in that. I think that Bush had an animus against Arafat, and he was actually pretty much guided by the so-called neocon counselors that he has, the people who are running this policy, who didn't want Arafat at all to be recognized or given any respect at all.
So you're suggesting that if we had continued the Camp David process under Carter, or subsequent processes, and actually brought about a resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that 9/11 might not have happened? I thought that Osama bin Laden had actually, his proclamation had been in the New York Times back in the 1990s, saying that he was going to attack us because we had soldiers on holy Saudi soil, men who were drinking alcohol, women who were driving, and because we were supporting the Saudi royal family, which was raping his country by pumping cheap oil.
You're quite right. That's what he said. And that was one of the main pieces of motivation, namely U.S. support for all kinds of dictatorial regimes in that area and U.S. troop presence in Saudi Arabia. But the other things that Osama bin Laden said had to do with the Palestinians and how they are given the short end of the stick here, and how the U.S. administration has, at least since Bush, very one-sidedly supported the kind of activities that the Sharon government, the right-wing Likud Sharon government, is doing vis-a-vis the Palestinians. See, what the Arabs look at every evening on TV are helicopter gunships, tanks, bulldozers, all made in the United States, wreaking havoc not only in Iraq, but on the West Bank, in Gaza. And they're very upset about this, and they should be. And so when you have somebody like our Defense Secretary, Don Rumsfeld, wring his hands and say, as he did exactly a year ago, the troubling unknown, this is a quote, the troubling unknown is whether the extremists are turning out newly trained terrorists faster than the United States can capture or kill them. It is quite clear to me that we do not have a coherent approach to this. And then he goes on to say, how do you persuade people not to become suicide bombers? How do you reduce the number of people attracted to terrorism? No one knows how to reduce that, end quote. Well, you have to look below the slogans.
So how do you reduce that, Ray?
What you do is you try to address their grievances. You see, it's sort of like fighting malaria. The way to defeat malaria is not to set up sharpshooters around the swamp and try to hit the mosquitoes with your rifles as they leave the swamp. The solution is to drain the swamp. And that's what we need to do. We need to drain the swamp of terrorist grievances. We need to drain the swamp of the people who are really, really being given the short end of things in that whole area. And only then can we create the kind of hope that will stop this kind of thing. You see, when you have no hope, I'm reminded, this is a little vignette that's illustrative. I'm reminded of 68 here in this town in Washington, where all hell broke loose after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Marion Wright Edelman, the head of the Children's Defense Fund, went down to 14th Street, where a lot of the violence was happening. The little boy, about 10 years old, he's throwing this big rock, just about to throw this rock into a picture window, and she grabs his arm and she says, "Son," she says, "don't do that." And he looks up at her and he says, "Why, ma'am?" And she says, "Well, think of your future." And he looked up and he said, "Ma'am, I ain't got no future." Womp into the picture window.
Right.
When
right.
People ain't got no future, that's the way they act.
That's what happens. Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Officers for Sanity, a 27-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency. His book coming out, next month?
Yes, in August.
Neocon again. I'm looking forward to that one. That sounds interesting.
Actually, I only have a chapter in it. There are a whole bunch of contributors to that book.
Great. From the Veterans Intelligence Officers for Sanity?
Yes, and from others.
Oh, that's great. Great. Ray McGovern, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It is much appreciated. Keep up the great work.
Thanks a lot.
Ray McGovern. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone numbers, your radio home for democracy. Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hi.
We're having an emergency broadcast system alert here right in the studio with me.
I hear that.
Yeah, I guess they're testing everything out right now. Anyhow, but it's not an emergency. It's just the EBS system going off. So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, increased alert, obviously, the whole country, at least the transportation systems went to orange, but the D.C. had already decided to put itself on a higher degree of alert, which is encouraging because, you know, we had fairly slow responses in some respects to the various planes flying over the White House recently. Our metro system's working, but there is a big increase in police in terms of metro stations and also bus stations they're very concerned about. We haven't heard about increased security at any of the sensitive buildings in the area, but clearly that there will be. Virginia Governor Mark Warner, who's a Democrat, has been talking about the lack of members of the National Guard to really respond to a crisis.
And because they're all in Iraq.
Exactly.
So what's going to come of that?
Not sure that anything will come of that right now. I think it may be an issue that will come up again once Congress gets back into session. I think a lot of people are going to use this politically. The Patriot Act people are going to try and use it to keep the Patriot Act. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton is taking the opportunity to try and push forward her Safe Trains Act, which would have increased a lot of security on the transportation system. It's really hard to tell how most of this is going to impact the Washington area or even the nation, but certainly, you know, it's reminded everybody that this is alive and well. Very interesting report in the BBC News on its website where it's talking about questions about Al-Qaeda and saying if a connection is established, it would show that the group is alive and well despite being the main target of U.S.-led global war on terror and the attention of police, blah, blah. War on terror is in parentheses.
Oh, really? In quotation marks?
Yes.
That's fascinating. So, this is the BBC.
This is the BBC.
Well, they've all watched the movie The Power of Nightmares, which was played on BBC. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it.
It is.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. I wrote a piece about it for Common Dreams about 6-8 months ago. It is absolutely mind-boggling. It just lays out how where this all came about and how U.S. government activity in so many different ways actually led to the creation of Al-Qaeda and brought it about. Not just Al-Qaeda, our hyper-response to it as well, but in any case. So the bombings happened in London this morning. We have now 33 confirmed dead, the number certainly climbing. 37 now, okay. 1,000 injured, according to the BBC website. And these three bombings in the tube, and then one in the double-decker bus. No indications that there's anything happening in the United States. I was talking with Congressman Earl Blumenauer this morning, and he said that our budget to frisk Granny at the airport is identical to the budget for the entire FBI. And he said that he said the TSA and the FBI both have $5 billion annual budgets.
I'm blown away.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I had to ask him for clarification. I said, are you sure? And he says, yeah, he's on the committee or something. He's like, yes, that's the situation. And at the same time, our nuclear plants are not protected. Our chemical plants are not protected. Our transportation infrastructure outside of the airlines is by and large not protected. This administration has done nothing to protect us. And what are they going to offer? They're probably going to offer jingoism and rants and more Patriot Act stuff rather than real protections, and they're not, as Ray McGovern said just a few minutes ago on this program, the co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, they're probably not going to drain the swamp. That is, they're not going to stop the grudge that they have against us, which is because we're occupying Iraq.
Yeah. Well, so. Yes, very, very interesting. And I'm sure that we're going to hear people taking political advantage of this, whether rightly or wrongly. There's no question people are going to use this.
Yeah. Yep. From your lip, yeah, unfortunately. Victoria Jones, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Victoria, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Much appreciated. Terrible, terrible situation in the United Kingdom. Guaranteed, you're going to see the demagogues jumping all over this on the afternoon and evening talk shows tomorrow morning. The right wing is going to be out making hay as fast as they can, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet at radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org. Welcome back to our program. P.J. Crowley is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and formerly was a special assistant for national security affairs to President Bill Clinton. P.J. Crowley, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom.
Glad to have you with us here.
A pleasure.
You wrote a great piece for the Center for American Progress, you and Lawrence Korb, a few days ago. Actually, I guess it originally was published in the Star Ledger, the New York Star Ledger, June 26th, about an exit strategy from Iraq. It appears if the BBC report is right, and if it turns out to be accurate, there's been no official notification of the police in the UK, but there is a group that claims to be Al-Qaeda in Europe that is claiming responsibility for this attack in London. And in their web posting, which is not dissimilar from web postings that have been made in the past for other claims that, you know, turned out to be valid, they say that the reason why they blew up these three subway stations, these three tube stations, or these three tube trains, and the bus, was because the British soldiers were what they called a massacre, committing a massacre in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they further warned Denmark and Italy. Do you think that that's probably the case, given what you know?
Well, I think there are great similarities between the Madrid bombing last year and what happened in London today. I will be astonished if this is not Al-Qaeda or one of its affiliates. I think it has all of the hallmarks of what Al-Qaeda is trying to do, attack in urban centers around the world, inflict as much damage as possible to civilian infrastructure and create casualties and fatalities. To put a political pressure on governments, you know, particularly governments that are supporting, you know, current operations in Iraq. So the timing here, last year it was Madrid on the eve of the Spanish election. This year it is, at the start of the G8 summit, you know, with the intent of putting political pressure on the Blair government. So I think this has all of the earmarks of being Al-Qaeda in action.
So if that's the case, How does the relationship between Al-Qaeda, well, actually, let me ask you a different question, PJ Crowley. What is their goal? If Al-Qaeda is responsible for this, what are they trying to accomplish with this?
Well, I think they continue to respond to, policies that maybe the United States has, or policies that Britain has, or other Western governments. I think they still continue to feel that their faith and aberration as it is, they've kind of hijacked Islam or a form of Islam, but they are responding to policies of Western governments and the influence that they have in the Middle East. It is nominally tied to Iraq, although obviously what Al-Qaeda was trying to do preceded 9/11. But when you look back to 1991 and the permanent presence that we, along with the British government, adopted in the Middle East after, the first Gulf War. Clearly, Al-Qaeda in general and bin Laden, in particular, are reacting to what they see, as an invasion of Western colonialists, into the Middle East, an area where they want to, gain and hold greater influence.
Do you think it would be accurate to say that one of the main goals of Al-Qaeda in this, assuming that they were responsible for this bombing, or more broadly, one of the main goals of Al-Qaeda in similar activities, such as in Spain and certainly here in New York, in the United States and New York, that one of their main goals was simply to get noticed, that they were really a rather small, marginalized group, and they were trying to become the warriors of the world?
Well, I think we got to be careful about treating Al-Qaeda as a monolithic organization. It's not. And in fact, it has shown itself to be adapting, quite chillingly to changes in the security environment since 9/11. Al-Qaeda is a network of networks. I think on 9/11 we saw a plot that was clearly hatched in Afghanistan and executed by Sheikh Mohammed with the clear support involvement of bin Laden and his immediate deputies in Kandahar. But since they've lost that safe haven, Al-Qaeda has changed. It has become a flatter organization, much more diverse, much more independent. So chances are the cell that was responsible for today's bombing had been given instructions at some point, do what you can when you can. But like we saw with the Madrid bombing last year, which was basically regionally hatched in Spain with some help from some folks in Morocco, chances are this was something that was engineered by a cell that already existed in England. And did not necessarily come from direction from whatever cave along the Pakistan-Afghani border bin Laden sits in today.
To what extent is the
is the response of George W. Bush to 9/11? First of all, what do you see as the differences between the way that the Clinton administration responded to an act of terrorism in the United States, that being the bombing of the Oklahoma Federal Building by Tim McVeigh, and who was a terrorist who was trying to you know, he had read the Turner Diaries, he wanted to bring about a reaction, a hyper reaction by the government, as was described in the Turner Diaries, that where the government would come in and suspend civil liberties and clamp down and reveal their real agenda, of uber fascism or something. And then in response to that, all the good white armed Christians would rise up, Protestant Christians, I should add, would rise up and take back the government and kill off all the people who weren't part of them. And that's the only folks who were left standing. I mean, Tim McVeigh's vision of what was going to come out of Oklahoma City was apparently not that dissimilar from bin Laden and Sheikh Mohammed's vision of what might come out of 9/11. And yet the response of Clinton to the Oklahoma City bombing was quite radically different from George W. Bush's response to 9/11.
Well, I think we've got to be careful. Terrorism is a tactic. It's not an adversary in and of itself. McVeigh and bin Laden have nothing in common. Bin Laden is an Islamic extremist.
McVeigh was a Christian extremist. serious. They were both religiously motivated.
However, I think our challenge today is that we're looking at terrorism one-dimensionally, and our response largely since 9/11 has been to rely on the military. Now, in the case of Afghanistan, clearly eliminating the al-Qaeda safe haven in Afghanistan was essential and necessary and has been very valuable. Given that al-Qaeda, is operating in an aberration of a great faith, but is basically contesting for the right to have the largest influence in terms of the direction that the Middle East will evolve in the future. We have to look at this much more broadly than we currently are. We can't expect to win this war on terror by picking off individual terrorists one at a time, whether it's in Iraq or whether it's somewhere else. We have to ultimately have a broad-based strategy that involves military action when necessary, involves good law enforcement and intelligence work when possible, but also has a political dimension, an economic dimension, a social dimension, a cultural dimension, a religious dimension, supporting moderate voices within Islam so that they can, in essence, wrest their faith back from these radicals. We have to do all of those things. And so just saying things like, we're going to stay on the offensive, it won't work because our military can't stay on the offensive indefinitely. We can't exist in a state of perpetual war. We ultimately have to do the things that are non-military in nature that get at the root causes and ultimately convince young people in the Middle East in particular that there's a better course than blowing themselves up in the interest of what they believe in.
We're talking with P.J. Crowley, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He was a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton. P.J., when you use the phrase war on terror, aren't you just buying into the same worldview that George Bush is trying to promote?
Well, I'm using the vernacular. It's a war against, in this particular case, radical Islamic extremism.
Is it really?
It really is.
Might it not instead be characterized as a war against people who don't want their territories occupied, whether you're talking about the Palestinians or whether you're talking about the Iraqis?
Well, the unfortunate term of
bin Laden and his view of the Saudis.
Well, war and military action will have a place. There are some hardcore within al-Qaeda that will have to be defeated. They can't be converted. But unfortunately, the net effect of what we've done in Iraq is to produce the next generation of extremists that are, in many respects, more dangerous because they're less predictable than bin Laden's generation. But what we really need here is a viable, broad-based national security strategy, so that we can help the Middle East reform and advance in ways that are going to be more tolerant, So some of these young people will seek jobs, not seek explosives. We have to obviously resolve the ongoing conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. We have to convince moderate Arabs and other of other faiths in the Middle East that the United States is a constructive force for change. Right now, they're responding to many of our policies, which they think are anti-Islamic, anti-Arab, and not in the interests of the Middle East.
P.J. Crowley, following 9/11, there were many in the United States who called on George W. Bush, President Bush, to respond to this as a crime, as a criminal act, to bring in Interpol, to get all the nations of the world together and hunt down, using police powers throughout the world, to hunt down the people who committed the act if military force was necessary to bring it in, but first to use police power. There was even initially some negotiations with the Taliban who had said that they were actually willing to turn over bin Laden to us if we could show some evidence that he was involved in 9/11. There might have been a process there that could have entirely avoided a war, might have given the people who were the victims of 9/11 closure if somebody had been arrested, brought to justice. I mean, this is how the Italians dealt with the Red Brigades after they murdered the Prime Minister of Italy. I mean, you know, Aldo Moro, they kidnapped him, stuck him in the trunk of a car, and he died. This is how the British responded to the IRA. This is how the Greeks responded in November 17. This is how, as I pointed out earlier, Bill Clinton responded to Tim McVeigh. What's wrong with saying right now that George W. Bush made a horrible blunder when he decided to use phrases like the war on terror and use war metaphors and alienate the rest of the world, when he had the whole world in his hand? I mean, everybody was with us, the French, Le Monde, you know, we're all Americans now. Everybody, in Tehran, they had a candlelight vigil after 9/11. Why are folks reluctant to say that Bush made a horrible mistake in not pursuing that path rather than the path that he did?
Well, let's parse that lengthy question.
Yeah, please do.
I mean, first of all, let's face it. In the aftermath of 9/11, eliminating the terrorist safe haven in Afghanistan was essential. That component of military action, I think, was quite valid. Unfortunately, as we've seen recently with some of the increase in violence and an ongoing conflict between the Taliban and coalition forces in Afghanistan, the great fear here is that we've robbed Peter to pay Paul by pulling resources out of Afghanistan prematurely in order to go to Iraq. We've in essence left the job in Afghanistan undone, and there's at least some chance that that Karzai will not be successful and that will continue to be a no man's land. Obviously, you know.
Right, but even going into Afghanistan, though, wouldn't have been a war on terror. It would have been going against essentially a lawless rogue state to recover a criminal who committed a horrible crime on our land and to take out his training ground.
Well, I think it's broader than that, but I don't think these are mutually exclusive things. Clearly, we have had success in the past in using intelligence and law enforcement to capture, prosecute, convict, and in one case execute someone who has perpetrated a terrorist act on the United States. We need to use all of the dimensions of our national power. You know, sometimes it'll be military, sometimes it'll be law enforcement intelligence. But I agree with the idea that to call it the war on terror suggests that there's only one solution here. It is obviously the solution that George Bush feels most strongly about, and yet, as many of our leaders say, we cannot ultimately defeat terrorism by military means. We're going to have to use other non-military means if we're ultimately going to reduce the threat and risk of terrorism to the American people. At some point in time, we've got to move in a different direction. The sooner the better.
Yeah, and it's important that we start looking forward. This has been a sort of a retrospective discussion. We're talking with P.J. Crowley, the Center for American Progress. We have about a minute left. You wrote a piece, Finding an Exit in Iraq. What's the exit?
Well, unfortunately, Iraq has become a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Most of the stated reasons why we went to Iraq have been discredited, but now that we're there, in fact, we've seen the infiltration of foreign fighters, the emergence of a very dangerous network in Zarqawi. So I think the primary mission that we have, you know, in Iraq today is to defeat al Zarqawi and make sure that that capability that we see in Iraq doesn't migrate elsewhere, you know, and or to places like London. Unfortunately, George Bush is correct in my view that today Iraq is the central front in the war on terror. It shouldn't have been that way, but it is. And so we do, in fact, now have a greater risk, a greater danger that we have to confront there. It's something that the Bush administration is largely responsible for creating.
And the solution?
The solution,
get out of Iraq?
We at some point, we have to get out of Iraq, clearly. The longer we're there, the worse it's going to be. But I think we also have to recognize that there are things that we need to do, in particular, defeat that foreign influence in Iraq and use that as a platform to move forward. But it's not going to be easy.
Great. P.J. Crowley, AmericanProgress.org, the site for the Center for American Progress, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thanks so much for being with us
today. Tom.
I appreciate it. Great interview. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. In the name of God, writes the poster on the internet, in the name of God, religious fundamentalists attacking, or at least claiming that they have attacked London today. Horrific bombings, 37 now confirmed dead, as many as 1,000 injured. The death toll sure to rise. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mike in Michigan on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Say, I want to go back to your comment there you made before the interview about the Republican noise machine gearing up.
Yeah.
And, well, it's already started. I was at the gym about an hour ago, and they had Fox News on in the locker room. I never watch it otherwise. But the anchorman was interviewing Senator Shelby from Alabama, who happens to be in London. And he asked Shelby, he said, I know this is a paraphrase, I know some Americans are concerned about the Patriot Act and civil rights, but don't you think we need to strengthen the Patriot Act rather than go the other way now that we've had these attacks?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, grim news, Mike. But, you know, predictable. Thank you for the call and for... Oh, jeez. You know, Bin Laden is going to exploit this, and Falwell is going to exploit this. The Muslim extremists who want power, who want political power in Afghanistan, in Iraq, throughout the world, ultimately, throughout the Islamic world in particular, are going to exploit this. And the radical right-wingers in the United States, and they're both right-wingers, right? This is the war of conservatives. This is the war of conservatives against conservatives. And in the name of God, we have repeatedly warned the British government and people. They say on this website, the heroic Mujahideen have carried out a blessed raid in London. This is horrible. This is rejoice, for it is time to take revenge against the British Zionist Crusader government in retaliation for the massacres Britain is committing in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm telling you, if we don't start measuring our responses and responding smart rather than simply hard. Yes, of course, you have to respond hard, but smart first. We're just going to get deeper and deeper and deeper into the swamp. And 50 years from now, we're going to be looking back and saying, or 30 years from now, we're going to be looking back and saying, gee, it's just like the last 30 years in Israel. People blowing themselves up all over the place. Is that the kind of world that we want to have? Is that the kind of world we want to be bringing our children up in? I don't think so. You know, it only benefits the big military contractors. And the demagogues. Watch them come out of the woodwork.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org, also podcast there. Mike German served for 16 years as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, one of the few agents actually credited with having prevented acts of terrorism back before the FBI put this front and center. In the early 1990s, Mike successfully infiltrated white supremacist groups in Los Angeles that were engaged in a bombing campaign against racial minorities and stockpiling weapons in preparation for a race war, did the same thing again in the 1990s after Tim McVeigh's Oklahoma City efforts. Mike German, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Great. Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate it.
Glad to have you here, Mike. Behind the lone terrorist, a pack mentality. You write about... Now, let's frame this for anybody who just tuned in. We had these horrific bombings this morning in London with three bombs went off in tube stations and train stations underground and one on a bus. And it looks like the death toll now is definitely at least 37 people, as many as 1,000 people injured. Major fatalities. An Al-Qaeda group, or a group that claims it's an Al-Qaeda group, has claimed credit for it and had done so within seconds of the bombing, which lends some credibility to their claim, saying that they did it specifically because we are, because Britain is participating in what they called a massacre in Afghanistan and Iraq, and called on Denmark and Italy as well to withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan. Mike, do you think that we might be looking at blowback from our foreign policies?
Well, certainly, you know, I think there is a tendency to have side impacts to what our policies are, unintended consequences. And, you know, I think it's always healthy to look at the unintended consequences and see if there is a population that's being impacted unintentionally and, you know, address those things as they occur. You know, what's the cause and what's the result is always a hard thing to try to put your finger on. But, you know, certainly there are populations out there that believe that American policies are harming them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, before the war happened, there was much of the world, I mean, the largest movement of demonstrations in the history of the planet, going out and essentially saying to George W. Bush, if you attack Iraq, a country that has not attacked us, you're going to create a mess. I mean, and here it is. Okay. So anyhow, you looked into McVeigh and his bombing in Oklahoma City, and you looked at I've read your article here, Behind the Lone Terrorist, a Pack Mentality, which is brilliant. It's in the Washington Post. And it seems that the point that you make throughout this article is that, first of all, the lone wolves are never really lone wolves. And secondly, that these people have an ideological agenda, that they've been raised in extremism and they have an ideological agenda. It seems that both those things could probably be said as well of the groups that have attacked us. We have Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who put together, actually, Mohammed Atta and and his merry band, you know, the guys who, the Saudis largely, the 15 of the 19, or so, what was it, 17, no, 15 of the 19 were Saudis, who attacked us on a 9/11. And that, you know, they were operating apparently somewhat independent of Osama bin Laden. And there's, you know, and perhaps the group in Spain, the guy who was the leader of that, it appears he just blew himself up recently. The group in Britain, this whole lone wolf thing. Tell us about this. How is it that these groups can be centralized and yet decentralized at the same time?
Right. Well, you know, a lot of what I wrote my article from was from my personal experience of learning how these groups operate from actually being inside them. And, you know, what I found was that there was this kind of underground movement going on, a community, a network that really didn't require any sort of formal organization to it. There were leaders that inspired people to join the movement and then train them on how to act once they were in the movement, but they created this leaderless resistance philosophy in which they could maintain their position as leaders and separate themselves from the criminal conspiracies by simply saying, you know, we want our followers to go out and do these terrible things, but we don't want to know about them before you do them, so that way the police, when they come and investigate it, can't lock up the leaders as well as the others in the group who are actually involved in the conspiracy. And really all terrorist groups act in the same way. I mean, one of the things I learned having been in the terrorist groups is that if you pay attention to what they're saying, you learn a lot more about what they're doing. And, you know, you look at a group like Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda means the base, and that's actually, I believe, what it was. It was a base, and, you know, it was a base where jihadists from around the world could come and train, could get financing, could be indoctrinated, could recruit, and that really the movement is spread much further than just Afghanistan, and their connections to Al-Qaeda are somewhat tenuous, and especially now after the invasion of Afghanistan, when that base has been destroyed, these different cells and different parts of the movement still exist, and they're actually in some ways more dangerous because it's harder to keep track of them.
So we shot ourselves in the foot.
Well, I mean, certainly allowing them to maintain a base of operations where they could train and recruit was not a good idea. And, you know, I certainly think going into Afghanistan was probably an appropriate thing. But the interesting thing about terrorists is, you know, by definition, a terrorist is weak. He's not politically strong enough to have a political support, and he's not militarily strong enough to have an army. You know, otherwise he'd be called the general of the rebel army rather than a terrorist, or the political opposition rather than a terrorist. So you got to understand that from the beginning they're very weak and they have very weak support. And there are criminal laws that criminalize most of the types of things that they're doing, so they have to be clandestine, which makes it very hard to have a large organization.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, but basically what they're trying to prove is that whoever they're fighting, their claim of legitimate, or their claim of authority over the people is illegitimate. And so in responding, if you read Carlos Marighella, who is one of the prolific writers about terrorism, he wrote the Mini Manual of the Urban Guerrilla. And what he said in that is the purpose of a terrorist attack is simply to force a government reaction, because he felt the government would always overreact and prove that you are truly oppressed.
Now, that was the basis of the Turner Diary. I've also read the Turner Diaries after the Oklahoma City bombing. I thought, this is interesting. I was curious about the ideology that might have motivated Tim McVeigh.
Right.
And I read that novel, and I was horrified by it. I mean, it was this incredible dystopia. The idea that anybody could actually read that and say, yes, this is how I want the world to be. First of all, it didn't baffle me, but it horrified me. It depressed me, frankly. It's a grim scenario. But and so much of it was so jingoistic. Although you read Mein Kampf and it's jingoistic also, you know, and you just, at what level of sophistication are these people operating? You ask yourself. On the one hand, on the other hand, they're out there and they're doing this stuff. We have terrorists in the United States. You have been among them. Tell us about them.
Well, they're very organized, much more organized than I thought. When I was first sent undercover to go into the white supremacist movement, I really expected to see what most Americans picture when they think of a white supremacist, kind of reckless, rednecks, uneducated people. But what I found was there were some very educated people, and it was a very organized movement. It had, you know, very sophisticated communications methods. It was an underground culture. They had their own books, their own magazines, their own newspapers, their own radio shows. I mean, even back in the early 90s, they were talking to me about email. And, of course, I was working for the FBI and didn't know anything about computers because we didn't have any.
Mm.
And, you know, here this movement was communicating through email even back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So they're very sophisticated, and you know, I mean, to sit and read something like the Turner Diaries, it's hard to read, like you said, and hard to imagine it, but it's a PhD physicist who wrote that.
Hmm.
And there are a lot of very smart people in the movement, which is what allows them to continue to exist. If they were stupid, they would have died out a long time ago. Not that there aren't stupid people who are drawn to the movement, because there are, you know, like any community, they have their geniuses and their imbeciles. And, you know, there are certainly plenty of imbeciles within that community.
Do you think Mike German, we're talking with Mike German, 16 years special agent for the FBI, one of the few agents actually credited with having prevented acts of terrorism here in the United States when he was with the FBI, infiltrated white supremacist groups in the United States, across the United States, actually. And do you think that we are facing a greater threat from white supremacist Christian fundamentalists in the United States or from Al-Qaeda overseas?
Well, certainly, if you're a person living here in the United States, the chances of you being injured in an act of domestic terrorism are much higher than the chances of you being hurt by an international terrorist.
And yet all of our attention seems to be focused on that. Nobody's talking about the Christian terrorists.
And that's really part of the problem, is that, you know, I don't think terrorism is something that we can ignore, whoever the terrorist is, whether they're right-wing, left-wing, domestic or international. You know, these are people. You know, the problem is it's not very difficult to make a bomb. And, you know, so we have to focus on all the people who are interested in making a bomb, and whether they're doing it because they're white supremacists or because they don't like the fact that some people eat meat, or because they don't like the fact that what religion people are.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter. We have to pay attention to all of them.
Why are we not paying attention to the white supremacist, largely Christian, I think exclusively Christian, terrorists among us, do you think?
Well, I hope that we are. I mean, certainly they're not in the media, but I think that the agents out on the street, I think, are dealing in their communities with the problems that they see, and I think that they do an effective job at doing that. I think at a national level and a policy level, for some reason, I think they're forgotten about, and there were some recent.
Could it be that we don't want to look at ourselves, as it were? I mean, you know, America is largely a white Christian nation. That America just doesn't want to acknowledge that part of itself, that shadow part.
Hard to say. I mean, certainly. I don't think that there's any doubt that there's extremists in every community, and you know, certainly there are extremists. Some of the extremists that I was with undercover were Christians. There are also other religious movements within the white supremacist movement that aren't based on a Judeo-Christian philosophy, or rather a separate religious philosophy, such as the creativity movement. But you know, I think that they are. It's just easy to dismiss them.
Yeah.
You know, their beliefs are so abhorrent that it's easy to think of them as just stupid as opposed to dangerous.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they've proven themselves they are dangerous.
Yeah. They're just those kooky guys, we say. Okay. Sunday, June 5th, 2005, in the Washington Post. You can find it in their archives, WashingtonPost.com. Mike German, he wrote, "Behind the Lone Terrorist, a Pack Mentality." Mike, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And keep up the good work. Keep spreading the good word. It's important that more people wake up to these issues. I do appreciate it. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, I've just been reading the last 10-15 minutes of the chat of the scroll. Well done, guys. Some fascinating discussion. Folks talking about the Turner Diaries, talk radio. It's a lot of good stuff. It's a fascinating discussions. I'm continually amazed. You put up a chat room, and people show up, and they have conversations, and they're not beating each other over the head, and they're not talking dirty. Well, occasionally. But, you know, by and large, it's like, you know, some really smart people having, you know, really pushing the envelope of conversation.
I'm continuously amazed and pleased. Kazakhstan. This, now, you know, yes, okay, we had this bombing in London this morning. I think it's important for us to also talk about some of the other things that are happening in the world. And this may well tie into this. Here, the bombing, the bombers said that they did this horrible act because of Britain's participation in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the Associated Press then reported yesterday, Dateline Astana, Kazakhstan, a regional alliance led by China and Russia. Now, consider for a moment, China and Russia, between the two of them, probably have more nuclear warheads than we do. They certainly have a much larger army than we do. I mean, China has an army that's over a million. And not only that, for us to make a destroyer, an aircraft carrier, a missile these days, we have to buy the parts from China. Our wonderful conservative politicians sold us down the tubes to communist China. But that's a whole other rant. Anyhow, a regional alliance led by communist China and Russia called Tuesday for the U.S. and its coalition allies in Afghanistan to set a date for withdrawing, not from Afghanistan or Iraq, but from several states in Central Asia. They want us out of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. In fact, those were two of the countries that were represented in this. Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan urged a deadline be set for withdrawal of the foreign forces from its member states in what light of what it said was a decline in active fighting in Afghanistan. See, we're using these states, the theoretical reason why we're in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan is so that we can have a military bases from which we can launch attacks into Afghanistan. But there are some who suggest that the reason that we're in these regions is because that's where all the oil is. The Saudi oil fields are now pumping one-third water. They're aging. Peak oil hit the United States in the 1970s. We're down to 2% of the world's oil here in this country. We consume 25% of the world's oil. And we can only produce 2%. There's a problem. So they've discovered these huge new oil fields in the last 20 years in this part of the world. And by coincidence, we've just built military bases there. Now they're saying, okay, guys, time to leave. The United States, notes the Associated Press, rejected the call for a deadline. In other words, a country asks us to leave its own borders. And we said no. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick said the U.S. military presence, quote, is determined by the terms of our bilateral agreements under which both countries have concluded that there is a benefit to both sides from our activities, end quote. U.S.-led military forces have been deployed at air bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan since the September 11, 2001 attacks to back up the anti-terrorist campaign in neighboring Afghanistan. You get this? Uzbekistan wants us to leave. Kyrgyzstan wants us to leave. And they got together with Tajikistan and Kazakhstan, communist China, and Russia to ask us to leave. And we said no. A little tiny story buried in your newspaper. This should have been the headline on page one. I'm telling you, if World War III is just around the corner, if it's not a religious war, it's going to be an oil war. And this is where it's going to begin. Something we need to pay attention to. Very careful attention to. I'm Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, and streaming around the planet on the internet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, also podcasts there. Welcome back to our program. Brian Katulis is the Director of Middle East Studies on National Security for the Center for American Progress. Brian, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Brian, what's your take on what happened this morning in London?
Well, first, it's a terrible and tragic atrocity, and we should all express our condolences to the families of the victims. But it's also a reminder of how vulnerable we are in today's world, and how unprotected we remain in the United States. We still have not done enough on Homeland Security.
Now, George Galloway, the member of Parliament, a member of Parliament, the British Parliament, who was just reelected along with Tony Blair and other. Well, Tony Blair wasn't actually reelected, but one of the, along with a whole bunch of other people who then reelected Tony Blair, made a statement this morning. He said, similar to what you said, he said, no one can condone acts of violence aimed at working people going about their daily lives. They've not been a party to this, nor are they responsible for the decisions of their government. And he said, we condemn those who have killed or injured them. Then he adds, the loss of innocent life, whether in this country or in Iraq, is precisely the result of a world that has become less safe and less peaceful in recent years. And then he goes on to urge the government of the UK to remove its people from harm's way, as the Spanish government acted to remove its people from harm's way by ending the occupation of Iraq and turning its full attention to the development of real solutions to the wider conflicts in the Middle East. Isn't this a rational statement?
I don't think it's a completely rational statement. I would tend to separate the two issues, because clearly we're in a war on terror.
How do you know?
Against terrorist networks, at least, because the attacks continue. If you look at the global attacks, they've tripled under George Bush's watch from 2003 to 2004. So these attacks continue.
But doesn't a war require a state?
True. I would say that we're against...
When Tim McVeigh attacked us, did we declare a war against white Christian terrorists?
We did not, but I think...
Why not?
Because they weren't as organized as we have right now, the threat that we face right now.
They're actually terribly organized across the United States. We have four or five of these guys who've done major attacks against the United... You know, Rudolph, we've had several murders in the United States as a result of these folks.
And we've responded to them with a law enforcement method.
Right. So why? I'm sorry. Pardon me for interrupting you, Brian. But it just makes me crazy when I hear people use this phrase "war on terror." This is like the war on drugs or the war on illiteracy. It's how do you have a war against a metaphor
or against a tactic? I think you have to listen carefully. I said war on terrorist networks. There are networks out there that are committed to attacking free societies and democratic societies like our own. I happen to think that the Bush administration and Blair's approach has not been the proper response to this. I don't think the proper response is necessarily to leave Iraq and Afghanistan immediately or tomorrow, because that won't eliminate these threats that we face here in Washington, D.C. and in New York.
How do you know?
Well, I think that if you look at the statements that are made by individuals who perpetrate these acts, they do cite Iraq and Afghanistan, but they also cite other factors too. And those threats are remain. I think Galloway's prescription is a bit simplistic. I think we need to separate the issue from Iraq from the broader threats that we face.
But isn't the reality, Brian Katulis, that if we had not intact Iraq in the first place, that this bombing in London probably never would have happened?
I think that's a hypothetical question. I think I would tend to agree that the threats would have been diminished had we not attacked Iraq. Iraq clearly wasn't the problem in this fight against global terrorist networks. We attacked the right country, Afghanistan, yet we've not followed through. Afghanistan is slipping back into instability and insecurity. And the simple fact is, whatever you want to call it, if you don't want to call it a war on terrorism, I tend not to use that phrase, but we're not, the threats have increased under George Bush's watch.
Yeah, we're in agreement there. What concerns me is when I hear people in the middle or on the left or wherever you want to characterize yourself as being, using the very, very carefully crafted language that Frank Luntz has run through his focus groups that the Republican Party puts together, these neocons and the Bush administration, to push emotional buttons in people that don't necessarily have rationality attached to them. And
I think that's right. But also, if you accept their language, you can evaluate their progress on it and say that they've not done anything at all to diminish this. If you look at Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, he wrote a memo in October of 2003 asking a question: are we capturing and killing more terrorists than the radical clerics are recruiting and training. Nobody in this administration has answered that question.
Even if you
accept their conception, which I agree with you, we should question that. But even if you accept it, we're losing.
Right, and in fact, Rumsfeld's memo, my recollection of it, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't that he asked if that the radical clerics are recruiting and training, but that we are creating. Was it not?
No, actually, I have it right in front of me.
Oh, okay.
Actually, says, are they recruiting, training, and deploying against us?
Okay.
And the
in that case, then I would say that that he's in error because our behaviors are creating a lot of these terrorists.
I think that's true. I think that the language that President Bush uses, that they hate us and attack us because they hate our freedoms, is tremendously simplistic.
Well, the 9/11 Commission blew a hole in that.
Right, exactly. And I think a lot of people need to wake up to that reality. I lived in the Middle East for about 5 or 6 years, and yes, there's a lot of enmity and hatred towards the United States. It's largely because of the policies and what we do, not who we are.
Yeah,
in fact, a lot of people actually emulate us and do aspire for the freedoms and democracy that we have. So the myth that President Bush and his administration perpetuates, I think people have to look beyond and say there are things that we do that undermine our own national security.
We this morning heard that the ambassador from Egypt to Iraq, a tremendous effort that Condoleezza Rice put into getting Arab nations to send their diplomats to Iraq, was executed. It's an unconfirmed report. Do you know anything more on that? And how do you think that relates to all of this?
Well, first of all, it is unconfirmed. Al Jazeera, I was looking at Al Jazeera earlier. They just have a statement from an organization saying that he has been executed. My reaction to that is horror, I'm not terribly surprised, because as we see, the extremists and the militants and whatever you call them in Iraq have been quite strategic in terms of who they choose to attack. The Egyptian ambassador was just one of three individuals who suffered from an attack. The Pakistani ambassador and Bahrain's senior diplomatic representative was attacked 2 days ago. And they're doing this in an effort to demonstrate that they don't support the initiatives led by this administration, the Bush administration, that any attempt to provide international support and international cooperation to this Iraqi transitional government will be resisted by these groups. And I think their message is heard loud and clear. I hope that Jordan has indicated so far that they'll continue with their plans, and I hope that other countries open up diplomatic representation in Baghdad, in part because the transitional government needs the global community support, not just the Bush administration support.
I was working down in Bogota, Colombia, about a decade ago, and several bombs went off within 10 blocks of me during the time I was there. And I had a conversation with, I want to say, a local government official, let's say, who said, you know, I said, do you think that this is going to turn into a war? Is this whole, you know, basically it was coming out of the drug war. Is this going to turn into a civil war? Is there going to be, you know, civil insurrection here? Are these going to get worse? And he said, no, I think it's going to get better. And I said, why? And he said, because there is a relationship. There's an equation. There's a mathematical equation you can actually put together about how many local people you have who are willing to support terrorists in order for the terrorists to actually continue to function within a society. And he said they don't have that kind of support here in Bogota. Over the short term, they can come in, they can, you know, make some noise, but they have to leave. They don't have the ability to get their tentacles deep into the city, into our society. It really struck me, you know, I hadn't thought of that before that it was said to me, and it really struck me as something that made a lot of sense. And time seems to be proving it out there, and proving out the inverse of it, or the reverse, the opposite of it in Iraq. Isn't it true that there has to be a fairly broad popular base of support, that you have to have at least, say, 100 or 200 civilians who are willing to hide and protect every one or two terrorists, for those terrorists to continue to function in a society? And if so, and the best numbers are, you know, somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 foreign fighters might be in Iraq, we're really not so much attacking, you know, fighting foreigners there, we're fighting Iraqis. If that's the case, aren't we up against a liberation movement in Iraq?
I think in part, I think it's quite convoluted. I think one fact that a lot of people in Washington gloss over, and an interesting number that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, is a poll of Iraqis, a recent poll done this spring that said that 45% of Iraqis support the attacks against coalition troops.
Right.
Now think about what that means. I don't know if you've seen these. UPI and Bloomberg, I think, reported on
this
recently.
Yeah, this was the Pew poll, wasn't it?
No, this was not the Pew poll. Pew does not do polling in Iraq. Few people and few organizations do. But this was a State Department-sponsored poll done by an Iraqi firm, which indicated that 45% of average Iraqis support the attacks against the coalition. Now, again, think about what that means. About 20% of Iraqis are Kurds, and we have fairly strong support among the Kurds. The Kurds love us from since the 1990s, early 1990s, and the support we provided to them. That means if you take out the Kurds, which are 20%, you have 80% left. More than half of those who remain, more than just the Sunnis, support the attacks against our coalition forces.
Which means that we're not fighting a war against terrorists.
Well, I think that's in part true. I mean, there are certain techniques and tactics that our opponent uses in Iraq that you can classify as terrorism. You need to think about that. Another fact from this poll is that a majority of Iraqis say that the coalition should stay, at least until the permanent government is elected, but that they do want some sort of timetable, which is one thing that people here in Washington don't want to talk about on either side of the aisle. I think we swallow hook, line, and sinker Bush's rhetoric that timetables embolden the terrorists, and I think people should start questioning that.
The Egyptian foreign ministry just confirmed that Egypt's top envoy has been killed.
Oh, that's awful.
Italy's ANSA news agency just reported this, just came down the wire service. Ihab al-Sharif,
was
killed by an al-Qaeda group for representing a, quote, tyrannical government allied to Jews and crusaders, end quote.
So, right.
Grim stuff. So it sounds to me like, you know, on the one hand, you're talking about, well, we've got this war on terror, we've got this war against terrorist networks. And on the other hand, you're saying that average Iraqis are supporting this. And so, you know, that would imply that it's not really terror or terrorism. I mean, beyond the fact that that's a tactic, and that's sort of like saying, let's have a war against people who use guns in wars. I mean, this is just a tactic, right? That really what's going on is that we had a successful invasion. You know, when George Bush declared victory on the USS Abraham Lincoln, we actually had victory. We had a successful invasion. We knocked over a government. We got their leaders. And then we had a totally screwed up and botched occupation.
That's correct. And we didn't follow through in terms of making Iraqi lives better. I was in Iraq in 2003 for 2 months. And then spent a week in 2004 in Iraq. And most Iraqis thought that what we were doing was intentional. They couldn't understand and fathom why there was no electricity. They figured if the world's greatest power with great military power could go in and defeat their leader, Saddam Hussein, they figured we could at least get the generators running. And the fact that we didn't, and the fact that there was no security and clean water and jobs and all of this, we didn't meet expectations, and people thought that there was a conspiracy behind this. They thought this was intentional. What analysts here in Washington evaluated as lack of planning on the war, post-war front, Iraqis thought was perfect planning. So you can understand why we get numbers for the support of attacks against our coalition forces.
So given all this, why is it that Democrats are by and large unwilling to step forward like Howard Dean did and say, you know, hey, this was a mistake, it was a blunder, let's just call it that, and let's do something about getting out?
Well, I think a lot of Democrats say the first part of that statement, that it was a mistake and a blunder. Unfortunately, you have some Democrats who like to pretend like they're still in power, and they want to do the responsible thing as opposed to stirring up debate here in the country. And I think we need a better debate on Iraq. We need to question some of the basic assumptions that undergird Bush's speech, which, if you listen to Bush's speech last week, it was the same speech that he gave a year ago.
And two years ago.
And, you know, his spin that, you know, the training of Iraqi troops are going well, that there's a lot of spin in there, that the U.S. is prevailing in Iraq. A lot of people here in power don't want to question. And I think we need to open up a broader debate on this. I mean, and implying that Iraq was somehow connected to the 9/11 attacks. I can't tell you how many times I'm on radio shows and talking to folks, and this comes up as if it's a fact. And the reason why people believe it is because our president continues to mislead the public about this. So
yeah, see, I just can't imagine
that if Bill Clinton was in office and he was trying to prosecute this war this way, that the Republicans wouldn't be up screaming every day, traitor, liar, you know, treason. Why? And every single person, every time somebody died in Iraq, that the Republicans would be up there going, he killed another one. You know, and I mean, just, I mean, think about it for a minute. What has happened to the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I agree with you, and this is the thing. Even if you don't like this conception of a war on terror, let's debate them on their terms and evaluate them on their terms. And if you look at the facts, the simple facts, and I mentioned this before, that international terrorist attacks have tripled from 2003 to 2004. Iraq was not a haven for international terrorists until we invaded and occupied the country, and now it's become a rallying cry for our enemies. Under Bush's watch, the spread of nuclear and chemical biological weapons has continued. There are more nuclear weapons. we are less safe. And even if you don't like the term that dominates the debate here, I think you can use those terms and say, well, look, you're not doing much on this.
You're not winning a war on terror. In fact, you're creating more of the terror itself.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that doesn't even mention Afghanistan and the backsliding that is happening in Afghanistan, because this administration has not been honest about the costs and kind of the objectives and what their plan is.
Yeah, as is their want. Brian Katulis, Director of Middle East Studies on National Security for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Brian, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
I do appreciate it. And well done. Keep up the good work there at the Center for American Progress, one of the finest institutions in the United States. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nets in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming.
Tell them, Leonard.
To the USA.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Lobbying forces battle over China bid for Unocal. New York Times reporting this. As the lobbying heats up in Washington over Unocal, the battle lines in the takeover contest are now clearly drawn, if somewhat oddly, by its suitors. Notes the New York Times. This is going to be a substantial story. I'm telling you, this is if the terrorist attack in London and others that may come down the road in, you know, the ongoing terrorist attacks in Iraq, you know, heaven forbid they do anything else here in the United States or in any of our allied countries. But nonetheless, if this stuff doesn't completely push this off the headlines, it is. I think that this story has the potential to get a lot of attention in the United States and play a role in the 2006 elections. You guys, Chevron now, you know, lobbying big time. My guess is that Chevron is going to successfully prevent Unocal from being sold to the Chinese. They want these assets. On the other hand, the Chinese are saying, "Hey, 73% of Unocal's assets are gas in Asia, and that's we're in Asia, and we want that gas." And we've got billions of dollars to buy it because you guys have been giving us all your money because you shop at Walmart and you buy all this Chinese junk. Well, it's not just Walmart. I mean, I'm looking at this on a Toshiba computer, and I looked under the bottom of it last week, and it says made in China. So what? I thought this was Japanese. Nope, made in China. We're all, you know, I mean, you try and buy a pair of blue jeans in the United States. You can't do it. Made in the United States. So China's sitting on all this power, all his money, and they're saying, you know, we need more energy. And Unocal's sitting on a bunch of energy. We'd like to have it. And odds are this isn't going to work for China. And they're going to be bitter, and then we're going to be facing some real problems if they decide not to continue buying our T-bills. And people, you know, who is the real enemy of the United States? Is it, in terms of talking about an ideological enemy, is it a country that believes in absolute tyranny over its people, like China? I think so, frankly. I have to say, I'm very concerned about China. have been for years. And, you know, you say, let's engage them. And that's worked to some extent, but also you don't sell out to them in the process. China had a better strategy than we. Our strategy was zero, nothing. And we're ending up no jobs, no strategy, nothing. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
I need to do something about it. You can help.